Principles.
Varishtaha,
greatest.
Saha Anujaha,
Saha Anujahi, with his younger brothers.
Pratyavarudha,
restricted.
Bhojanaha,
acceptance of necessities.
Tatam.
How?
Pravitta.
Engaged.
Tim.
What?
Akarashit.
Executed.
Tataha.
Thereafter. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Shomaka Muni asked, after killing his enemies, who desired to usurp his rightful inheritance, how did the greatest of all religious men, Maharaj Yudhishthira, assisted by his brothers, rule the subjects? Surely he could not freely enjoy his kingdom with unrestricted consciousness. Anybody have any tissue?
I guess that's rare around here.
Okay.
Okay, good. I'm some emergency.
Purport. Maharaj Yudhishthira was the greatest of all men of religion. Thus he was not at all inclined to fight with his cousins for the sake of enjoying the kingdom. He fought for the right cause because the kingdom of Hastinapura was his rightful inheritance, and his cousins wanted to usurp it for themselves. He fought, therefore, for the right cause under the guidance of Lord Sri Krishna. But he could not enjoy the results of his victory because his cousins were all killed in this fight. He therefore ruled over the kingdom as a matter of duty, assisted by his younger brothers. The inquiry was important for Shonaka Rishi, who wanted to know about the behavior of Maharaj Yudhishthira when he was at ease to enjoy the kingdom. What the actual topic under discussion here is the introduction to Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the history leading up to the manifestation of Srimad Bhagavatam from the lips of Sri Vidya Goswami, which involves Parikshit Maharaj and his being cursed, and leading up to that, to the assuming of the emperorship by Parikshit, is the history of the departure of the Pandavas. So that's where this first canto history begins.
This began in chapter 7, just after the battle of Kurukshetra.
Maharaj Yudhishthira is behaving like an ideal Kshatriya, not a typical Kshatriya. Kshatriyas are mostly in the mode of passion. Those who are mixed in the modes of passion and ignorance, they're Vaishyas. But between the Kshatriyas and Brahmins, sometimes you have some admixture. You have Brahmins who are a little passionate, who get involved in politics and other worldly affairs. And you have some Kshatriyas who are really not so much interested in fighting and conquering. They're devoted to Dharma. Actually, the Kshatriyas are meant to defend Dharma, not just fight to acquire property for themselves. Those who want simply to acquire property for themselves are not Kshatriyas, they're Vaishyas, they're businessmen. Whether they're employing violence in their business, it doesn't make them a Kshatriya. Businessmen who indulge in violence, who instead of just competing fairly with their competitors, they blow them up, like I've seen in Russia, one Italian restaurant in Sochi. It was blown up by gangsters, by some competing businessmen. It's one way to deal with your competition. But that, it's rare for Vaishyas to resort to violence. But it doesn't make them a Kshatriya just because they're fighting and using violence. Kshatriya has to be a proper Kshatriya, one must be working to defend religion, Dharma. And that's also the essence of what it means to function as a Brahmin. Also, to work for the defense of Dharma. But the means, the end is the same for the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, but the method is different. The Brahmins are non-violence. They defend Dharma by the power of their words. And the Kshatriyas actually use physical power, violence when necessary, to defend Dharma. So there's a common ground between the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, and sometimes there's some shade, some fuzzy shade in between the difference, the gap between being a Brahmin and being a Kshatriya. Yudhishthira was as brahminical as a Kshatriya could be before he just gives up takes off his crown and retires to the forest. Yudhishthira was more inclined to that. For himself, he would rather have just abdicated and let Duryodhana have the throne. But there were other considerations, especially the considerations of what his brothers thought, what others thought, what Vyasadeva thought, what Krishna thought. He had to take into account. And he had to, first of all, take into account what the dictates of Dharma told him, that he had to stand up for justice, even if not for himself, just for the sake of justice. He had to stand up against Duryodhana. But still, his inclination was more sattvic. He was more happy sitting with Brahmins and studying the Shastras than fighting on the battlefield. But he fought well when necessary. And he did win. He won back his rightful inheritance. But as a result, the whole dynasty was destroyed. And he blame himself. Although it wasn't his fault, the Kuru dynasty was cursed already. From the irreligious behavior of Dhritarashtra, who should have never taken the throne in the first place, he was disqualified, not only by being physically blind, but by being selfish, being concerned for the welfare of his family rather than the welfare of the whole state. Therefore, he was disqualified to sit on the throne of the Kuru dynasty. And his being on the throne was a major cause of the disaster that led to the destruction. And then there were other factors, but especially that he did not stop his son Duryodhan from his wickedness. So it's not Yudhishthira's fault that the dynasty was annihilated, but he blamed himself anyway, because he was fighting, as he saw it, to get the kingdom for himself and his brothers. And for that purpose, so much blood was shed. So many women were left widows. Strina mud hotapam duna. Yodro ho salvi ho titaha. Karna bir griha medi ayanam kobo vipoito. The enmity, the hostility toward me of these pious women. Their husbands may have been wicked, some of them. But the women were pious. Even the wife of Ravana, the wife of Hiranyakashipu, were pious ladies. And certainly the wives of most of the Kuru kings were very spiritually qualified ladies. And he had murdered their husbands and left them widows. And he's thinking that their hostility toward me now, because of my killing their husbands, is a burden of sin that I cannot wash away by performing some animal sacrifice, by killing more creatures in sacrifice. Any more, nahipam kena pam karamba, surayava sura pritam, brahmahadyam tatai vai kam, na yagyaya marshtum arhati. Just like it's not appropriate to try to clean a pot that has been contaminated by having liquor, alcohol in it, to use alcohol to clean it. That won't purify the pot. There are other means prescribed in the Shastras for purifying something touched by alcohol. It's not to use some alcoholic cleanser. Many of the cleansers we use in the West contain alcohol. On the airplane, they give you these, you know, little napkins soaked in alcohol to wipe your face with. That's, anyway, that doesn't clean the pot to use alcohol to wash away the alcohol. And in the same way, my killing some horse or cow in a sacrifice isn't going to relieve me for all the human blood I've shed and all the enmity I've acquired. So this is how he was thinking. He, therefore, pratyavaruda bhojana. He felt very repentful. In fact, it took a long time to convince him to even accept the throne after the battle. Only Bhishmadeva could do that. That we read about in the previous chapter, the instructions given to Yudhishthira by Bhishmadeva. So now he finally found the advice and the thorough explanations given to him of the real principles of his dharma. From Bhishmadeva, Yudhishthira finally understood and accepted his duty to sit on the throne now that he has conquered. And now he's sitting. But pratyavaruda bhojana, he did it in a very repentful mood, refusing to indulge in the opportunities for sense gratification that come in such a position. That's what the word means. Pratyavaruda, restrained, bhojana, to material enjoyment. And his brothers too, following his lead. They didn't just go to town and enjoy all the facilities of being on the throne. They accepted everything. They accepted this position and this power simply as a matter of duty. And we hear, maybe from the Mahabharata, that Yudhishthira did sit on the throne for a few decades, maybe 30 years or something, before the end. Here in the Bhagavatam, we don't get that chronology. It seems like you turn the page from one chapter to the next, and the end is at hand. But actually, there was several decades that Yudhishthira was ruling the kingdom of Hastinapura. So, Shonaka
is inquiring,
what happened then? So what happens, as described in the following chapters, I'll give you a quick summary. Prabhupada didn't write a chapter summary. Prabhupada didn't start writing chapter summaries until the sixth canto. Which one? Fifth canto. Although these are based on the chapter summaries given by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. But Prabhupada got the idea to paraphrase these chapter summaries only in the beginning in the fifth canto. In this chapter, it described how Krishna, who had been visiting Hastinapur, he was a participant in the battle, and he stayed after the battle to console the survivors, to give them instructions, to please his sister especially, and to see Yudhisthira properly established on the throne. He stayed a few months, and now, as going to be described in this chapter, he goes home to Dwarka. And we read about the loving way in which the inhabitants of Hastinapur saw him off. The next chapter describes his entrance into Hastinapur, back to Dwarka from Hastinapur. Krishna, not only once, but several times, would leave Dwarka to visit his devotees in other places. So this wasn't a one-time affair. It happened quite often, not quite often, but it happened repeatedly. Krishna leaving Dwarka and then coming back. But every time he would come back, it was the greatest festival. Just like when Prabhupada would arrive at a temple. No matter how many times he'd been there before, even if he'd been there 1 month before, the devotees would be in ecstasy. Prabhupada is coming. So Krishna now is coming back to Dwarka. He's greeted by the citizens. Then he enters his palaces. He's greeted by his mothers and his father. And then he enters the inner palaces and is greeted by his queens. And that's the contents of this 11th chapter. In the 12th chapter, Parikshit is born. Parikshit, who had been saved by Krishna in the womb of his mother Uttara, took his birth under all auspicious signs. And the Brahman astrologers predicted how great a king he would be. Compared him to all the great kings of the past. And predicted that he would be cursed. He would stop Kali from entering his kingdom. And then he would be cursed by a Brahmin boy and would sit to fast till death at the bank of the Ganga and be taught the Srimad Bhagavatam by Shukadeva. All this was predicted by the astrologers at Parikshit's birth. So this is these chapters form the prelude to the introduction or the presentation of Srimad Bhagavatam. Hare Krishna. So any questions or comments?
You got it. First.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Donald, can you spare this?
Someone has it this feeling when he got this position of a king, he is involved to enjoy these opportunities.
Well, we can distinguish. There are certain opulences that you require for your service. Suppose you have to preach in a big city, as not practical to do it on the public buses. You need a car. So you're given a car by your authorities. It's for your service, not just for joyriding. Then you're accepted, unquestionably. It's for my service, it's required. My service is required of me. And this facility, I'm being told, not my own, just my own idea, but I'm being told that I should accept it for my service. Then you accept. And no qualms. But then there are optional opulences. a huge feast. It's up to you how much of that feast you eat. You know, if your doctor has told you, you know, lay off hot peppers, and they serve out pepper pakoras, you can skip them. It's up to you how much to indulge, and whether to violate your own rules in the name of indulgence. So you have to distinguish when it's mandatory sense gratification and when it's optional sense gratification. Optional sense gratification, Krishna gives it to you, accept, but you don't have to overindulge. And you don't have to look for more. Krishna said to you, one scoop of ice cream, you don't have to look for a whole gallon. Okay? Done around here?
Thank you very much for your request. I'm trying to understand more the topic about the gradations of brahmanas, according to their mode of goodness, and sometimes some maybe a bit passionate, like you said, and gets involved in politics. And I remember when one time you were describing this, how you were describing how there's different types of brahmanas, and then you gave an example of Vyasadeva.
Yeah.
How he was writing scripture, not much of a social. writing scripture like in this cave, not much involved. But we see, like, enough of, I was reading recently how, well, he was involved often with the gurus, it seems, especially.
He came down to Hastinapur a few times to protect the Pandavas.
Yeah. And like, stories,
and advise them.
And like stories of, I was reading Gandhari, which was instructed by Vyasadeva.
Yes. So you need to come down that often.
Like,
it takes, you know, to walk to Delhi from Butter Ashram takes 1 month.
But he had some that lived more in the society, like for example, Dronacharya,
Yukacharya. Yeah, they lived in the court, yeah.
They lived in the court, so they're like advisors.
Yes. And then some Brahmins get directly involved in politics. They even take office. That's rare and not generally advised.
Yeah. Like Dronacharya, I mean, they were fighting.
They were, yeah, not just teaching, but also they were on the battlefield.
Yeah,
I don't know how, I don't know the history of Mahabharata, whether Dronacharya was always in every battle. I don't know. I guess he was. His inclination was the inclination of a fighter. He liked to fight, not just teach fighting.
But the Brahmanas that are more reclusive, are they also to be on a higher level?
In a sense, yes. Although there's need for both kinds, but they're purer Brahmins, those who avoid any involvement with government. Yes, they're actually purer.
Now,
but indeed, there's need for some Brahmins to help the government. Government needs advice. So it's, you know, there are plenty of Brahmins who have some passion in them, and we need them also.
Some are more interested in more to study, research, and do some things, and some are more involved. They'll go to a city and preach.
And you see what happens when all the Brahmins just want to study and nobody wants to manage, and things don't get managed. You see that?
Yeah. Like for changing, I mean, both is needed for changing society.
Yeah, or for keeping society together. Well, you know, the Kshatriyas need guidance. But if the Kshatriyas are ideal Kshatriyas, they don't need so much guidance. They don't have to be supervised so heavily. You know, a few first-class advisors can take care of first-class Kshatriyas. But when the Kshatriyas are less qualified, then they have to be supervised more heavily by the Brahmins, and the Brahmins have to get more involved. Or else there's trouble. Which is what happens in Kali Yuga. The Brahmins neglect their real duties, the Kshatriyas become unled, unruly, and everything goes to hell. Okay, anything else?
Yes. Yudhishthira's position is just like Rajarshi or anything, something like that.
Well, he's definitely a Rajarshi, yes. He's a... Well, I don't know, is he called a Rajarshi? Probably not. He deserves to be called a Rajarshi, but I don't know that he is. A Rishi takes students and he teaches. So Yudhishthira, he studied. He liked to study, but he didn't teach. So maybe we don't call him a Rishi because he wasn't involved in teaching.
Can you say that Chanakya Pandit was a passionate traveler?
Yes, yeah, he was on the, definitely on the passionate side. Because he went out of his way to stir up political things. Not only he advised, but he precipitated the dragging down of one dynasty and replacing it with another. That was his personal initiative. So that's about as passionate as the Brahmin can get to, be the spearhead of a revolution.
Was his intelligence contaminated because of that involvement?
Well, it depends on what level you're looking down. From our level, he was better than us. From the level of real pure Brahmins, yeah, he was less than a real pure Brahmin, but he served his purpose. He wasn't a pure Vaishnava. The Prabhupada quotes from him so many times, practical instructions, even though he wasn't a pure Vaishnava. Who knows what kind of Vaishnava he was at all? But his advice was very appropriate for practical living. Things a devotee should know. Treat other women than your wife as mother. We should know and follow that. Other people's property is garbage. Garbage on the street that you wouldn't want to touch. These are practical instructions. So he's an authority on his own level. He served his purpose, and he saved India. If he had not arranged for that revolution, then India would have been conquered by foreigners earlier than it was.
Do we need such Brahmins now?
Yeah. Prabhupada picked up such people. Then we have Brahmins in ISKCON who are very passionate. Some of the people who helped Prabhupada organize ISKCON are in that category. So we had need in the beginning of ISKCON, and there's going to be conflict in the world in the future. We're going to need defenders also. The thing is, we need Kshatriyas, but what kind of Kshatriyas? I'm not going to raise armies and start fighting wars. ISKCON against the Maharajas or something. That's not in the modern world. We don't need. It's not something ISKCON should do. Actually, get involved in raising a militia and fighting people. So we're not going to have typical Kshatriyas anyway. Everybody serving in the core of ISKCON is basically a Brahmin. Some of them, though, may be doing administrative and even legislative work, so they're acting more like Kshatriyas. Brahmins who are almost Kshatriyas. We have some like that in ISKCON, and we will need in the future also. To get ISKCON established, to after you go out and save the world, you're going to have to do some fighting. If not bloodshed, at least, we'll have to get involved in politics. And in competing for the hearts of society. Okay? Done with everyone?
You said that Rajarshi did teach also?
Well, I guess I was just thinking on the run. Actually, not all rishis necessarily teach. But rishis engage in severe austerities, spend most of their time simply meditating. It's not typical for a rishi to be running a government. So, I don't know. We'd have to look at Bhishmadeva's instructions to see what is the actual qualification to be named a Rajarshi. I just don't know that well. So maybe Yudhishthira does fit the bill, that he deserves to be called Rajarshi. Rajarshi? Okay, so Prabhupada said he's a Rajarshi.
Also, in the story of King Jaina, there's a pretty existing disturbance that the Brahmanas, they killed him and then they placed somebody else.
Right.
And then in that section, they probably explains that. They don't actually want to get involved, but forbidden people, they put somebody, but they themselves will not take the throne.
In the emergency situation, the great sage, these were the seven rishis who did this. Bhrigu and the others that killed Vaina. So they're more or less pure Brahmins. They ordinarily would not get involved in politics. They might perform a yajna for a king, but they didn't serve as advisors. The Sapta rishis, seven major rishis. But this was an emergency situation, and they stepped in and killed him. But you don't see the same sages going around killing other people. It was a one-time exception.
To take Bhrigu again, that he was pretty involved with Daksha. You know, he was a king and ruler and he protected him. He was like the example that's part of
it. Yeah, okay.
Any comment on that?
Well, for him to get involved in such a conflict means he had some passion in him. You don't find anybody who's not a pure devotee who's situated completely in pure goodness. Any other Brahmin or anybody else is going to be influenced by a mixture of modes. Anyone who's not a pure devotee. And even pure devotees, they have their physical and bodies and minds sometimes influenced by passion for the sake of Krishna's service, sometimes. Krishna wants some of his devotees to be fighters. So even for pure devotional service, there may be some passion involved. But as far as non-devotees, there's always a mixture, there's always some influence of the lower modes in anybody who's not a pure devotee. Okay.
Sorry.
There are different versions of Mahabharata. What do you think? Does ISKCON need a good translation of Mahabharata, and how to do it in your opinion?
Well, I don't know if we absolutely need it. It's something we could have. Maybe Vidyananda Maharaj will finish it. Maybe, I don't know if he's decided definitely not to finish it. Then maybe in the future someone else who's competent could do it. It would be good to have it. But it's not our absolute first priority. We don't absolutely need it. Prabhupada has already explained so much of the instructions of Mahabharata in his purports. And there are other translations which are usable. You know, they're not completely distorting the story. So you can read the other translations of Mahabharata also. If we present Mahabharata, we should present it with Vaishnava commentary. Then it will be something very valuable. Put it in context and reconcile it with Srimad Bhagavatam, then that would be a great contribution. Srimad Bhagavatam himself presents a lot of
this Mahabharata as my, is it Madhura who in third attempt of Bhagavatam to talk into my trade, says I'm fed up with all these descriptions written by Vyasadeva Mahabharata, I'm satiated with them, please tell me something about Krishna. And Prabhupada in his commentary speaks about Mahabharata in a very, not
dismiss it exactly, but he says it's mostly mundane, and the only transcendental part in Mahabharata is the instructions of the Bhagavad Gita, and the whole body of Mahabharata is meant to bring people to the point of taking the instructions of the Bhagavad Gita properly.
Then,
so it was like Vidura, who was contemporary, and, yes, and the character of Mahabharata himself was not of such a high opinion. And says that you have a speech for formations.
Well, okay, that's from that criticism is from a very elevated, pure devotee viewpoint. Mahabharata still is very useful for the general public to introduce to them the basic principles of Dharma. Better, much better than people in India kept Mahabharata at the center, and Ramayana as the center of their culture, instead of switching to Mickey Mouse and Michael Jackson. It would have been better, you know, that the Indians kept their interest in Mahabharata, but they're losing it. Yeah, ISKCON, I don't know if we absolutely need it.
It has become also a fashion in many places that I know of. Like devotees deliberately studied Mahabharata and then entertained their audiences with stories from it, extensive stories. And it's interesting. And it's very involved, and they may also come across as people who know the Shastra very well, but some of these stories are not so spiritually elevated. They're mostly teaching some karmakandhya ideas or dharma ideas.
We should be presenting Srimad Bhagavatam, and so it's not just we read the verse and then go off into some other tangent and talk about everything else but what the Bhagavatam wants to talk about. We can use these stories and this information from other sources, but we have to keep our focus the Bhagavatam and what it's teaching. And if we haven't studied it sufficiently, that's hard to do. If you don't even know what the focus of the Bhagavatam is, how can you stick to it?
It's like Prabhupada himself, as far as I remember, somebody mentioned he never read Mahabharata, and all these descriptions and passages from Mahabharata and his commentaries in the first canto are taken from somewhere else. And he said that I just heard it in childhood, but I never read it. So
yes,
that explains many inaccuracies in his commentaries on Mahabharata.
Okay. Well, then we should take that as an example. The Prabhupada didn't think it was absolutely necessary to read Mahabharata. What Vishwanath Chakravarti in the Raghavart Machakmika, which is his textbook on how to perform Raghunuga Bhakti, he says for one who's practicing Raghunuga Bhakti, which I think most of us are not right now, but those who are practicing Raghunuga Bhakti, for them, the study of other Puranas is neither detrimental nor beneficial. It's just neutral. You can do it if you want, but it doesn't really do much.
Sometimes we see that maybe devotees are even lacking in basic principles.
Yeah, but if they read Prabhupada's purport, especially in the first canto, they'd pick up those principles. They don't need to go directly to Mahabharata.
So it's just a application of following Prabhupada.
You mean to think that I need to study Mahabharata in order to be civilized?
What I mean is that sometimes like devotees do some things that are pretty much like not very dharmic.
Yeah, well, they do go to Mahabharata, pick up something that's meant for somebody else, not you, and misapply it.
No, I mean in the sense of dharmic, like, for example, illicit sex, the problem, or
yeah,
some common moral principles that are like not followed,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yes.
Are we going to give a list of like men that be so civilized?
Yes.
So, sometimes it seems that there's maybe an idea of, well, okay, if we're not that advanced, then maybe we just should learn some basic things about civilization, then go to Krishna consciousness.
No, but in our basic training of Krishna consciousness, we get all that. We get all the, you know, the basic training of Krishna consciousness, as Prabhupada presented it, using his textbooks, his Gita commentaries and Bhagavatam commentaries by Prabhupada, in those basic texts presented by Srila Prabhupada, all these foundational principles of how to be a civilized human being, they're included in the basic training of your Krishna consciousness. We don't need to go to other sources. If what you're talking about is need to require the basic principles of how to be a civilized human being, Prabhupada taught us all of that. You know, okay, Prabhupada didn't say what to do if you touch your head, you know, which mantras to chant. You know, but that's not essential. All the essential things Prabhupada taught us, how to be a civilized human being. I think the devotees who are having problems being civilized need to study Prabhupada more and try to follow him.
Is that okay?
Yes. Okay. So we'll stop here. Thank you all. Glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam.